From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Singer Bob Marley became an international star with his message of peace and understanding. That was an urgent message in Jamaica, which in the 1970s was torn apart by violence thanks to rampant police, political corruption, gang warfare, and the CIA. This hour, On Point, a compelling new look at politics, drugs, music, the U.S., Jamaica, and Bob Marley. You can join us on air or online. What do you think of when you hear Bob Marley's music? Are you surprised to know the man who sang about peace lived in a world of violence? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Marlon James. He is professor of English at McAllister College, and his new book, which the New York Times has called monumental, sweeping, and mythic, is A Brief History of Seven Killings. Welcome, Marlon.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on, and congrats on all that praise from the New York Times. I got to ask you first, the book is called A Brief History of Seven Killings, but the story isn't brief, and there are a lot more than seven killings. So how'd you come up with that title?
Oh, man, I can't even remember now. I think on a very serious level, the actual seven killings are pretty brief, and I think it's because usually when they were mentioned, if they were mentioned at all, there were always these footnotes or one lines or rumors. It was always the actual history of what happened to them, to these men, could actually fit in a pamphlet. So that's kind of where it came from. So it became sort of tongue-in-cheek, but also kind of a bitter commentary on what happens. The title also appears again near the end of the book as the title of something else completely. But that was it mostly, that that the story, the after story of this event was pretty, you know, at a brief to the point of non-existent.
Let me ask you about Bob Marley. So much of this book, it's not a historical novel, but you imagine some of the events around his attempted assassination. Do you remember when you first heard of Bob Marley and his music?
I first heard of Bob Marley pretty much when I was young. I mean, in 1976, when he was shot, I was 6 years old. Bob Marley was something, Bob Marley's music was something you heard, not on the radio. You heard it, neighbors playing it, people older than you playing it, the new emerging Jamaican middle class that was defining itself. That's what was playing on sound systems and so on. But there was also this sense already that he was this big star that was kind of removed from the rest of us. So there was always this perception that he was just doing this, becoming famous and doing this great thing overseas. But on the radio, he wasn't being played, and in the streets, a new music form was already emerging. So it was kind of, even then you knew he had a kind of really tricky space in Jamaican culture and Jamaican life.
So you're saying he was not played on the radio in Jamaica, but he
Jamaicans weren't played on the radio.
What did they played American music and British music, right?
Yeah, usually. And one of my characters mentions it, that you the first thing you notice when you came to Jamaica is you never heard reggae on the radio. There's disco and ABBA. A Jamaican would know Tony Orlando and Don, who nobody should know. there was that. And it took a while. In fact, one of the first radio DJs to play reggae was actually the Prime Minister's wife. And she was known for that, for breaking Jamaican culture onto Jamaican radio. So he wouldn't have been on the radio. And in the streets, Jamaican streets and in the ghettos and so on, younger people were already rising up and making this music. It was sort of the counterpoint to hip-hop in New York. So our dancehall reggae, we already started that sort of beginnings of street music. So he was in a tricky spot where he was world famous, known to everybody, but his music honestly didn't really infiltrate Jamaican radio until he got super famous, and also when news came out that he was sick, that he was dying.
And when he died, what did that mean to you? What did he symbolize?
When he died, at the time he died, I think he symbolized just the sort of epic scale that he lived. Sometimes you don't know somebody's famous until your famous people say they're famous. So when his news of not just his death but his sickness was something that you saw in the American media and so on, you realize that the scope of what he achieved. As I got older, the more I thought about it, and the more I think about that whole event, from the assassination attempt to his death, you know, I realized how much of a loss it was. You know, he died really young, and just how much of it is shrouded in this mystery. Mm-hmm. What happened to him? He just blazed bright and then disappeared. And also what it meant for Jamaica and Jamaican music, there was always, now there isn't, but there was always a very conflicted reaction to his music in Jamaica, which we kind of forget now, but there was.
So would you give us a brief thumbnail of the book? I know.
You know, Flannery O'Connor says literature should resist paraphrase. I'm agreeing with her. It starts off with a touchpoint event, which is the assassination attempt on Bob Marley, who in the book is never named. And it follows the lives of several people who are directly and indirectly connected to that event. Everyone from the men who tried to kill him to a woman who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And such a brief event, such an instant event, had consequences that stretch over nearly 30 years and goes from Kingston, Jamaica, to Brooklyn, to Miami, to the Bronx.
And you did a good job with that. I wouldn't have been able to do it so well. You also, there's a huge political theme woven throughout the book, that Marley's right. life was tied closely to a battle between two political parties in mm-hmm. Jamaica.
Yeah, the thing about Marley and his, where he, the only person I could probably compare him to is Fela Kuti, in the sense of a primarily musician, who still sort of found himself at the very epicenter of politics. He was the one person who could unite both of these warring tribes. But he was also the one person who had so many forces aligned against them. It's amazing how those two things work at the same time. Marley's house was the one place in Kingston where, regardless of your political affiliation, you could hang out. So men who would have been shooting to kill each other on a Tuesday would be playing dominoes at his house on a Wednesday. And there's even, and the bigger significance also being that his house was on Hope Road, where the Prime Minister and the Governor General, pretty much the representative of the Queen, lived. So it says something that it speaks volumes about who's really leading the country by who's living on Hope Road. He was at the epicenter of that, and it was bound to explode in one way or another, because as much as he was a force for peace, he was aligned with and working with people who were very committed to war. And it didn't take long for Marley, because he's growing in influence and you know, allowing people to speak their minds, and even more importantly, speaking the language coming out of their mouths, the Jamaican dialect, that he was becoming too much of a third force, too much of a somebody to consider, to reckon with, to take seriously. He was more than just a musician.
And there was a piece of this that was gang warfare tied into it. There were the two political mm-hmm. parties. Gangs chose party allegiances, but right. the U.S. was involved as well through the CIA. Why did the U.S. care what was happening in Jamaican politics at that time?
In a very, very big way, because the Prime Minister at the time, Michael Manley, announced that Jamaica was going to go socialist, democratic socialism. And there was a lot of working already with Cuba. Fidel Castro visited quite a few times. There was a lot of aid and development going into Jamaica, the Jose Marti High School, for one. But if you were a conspiracy nut, then certain things would also start to frighten you, such as the news being read in English for a country that could barely, sorry, news being read in Spanish for a country that still couldn't read English with a literacy rate. So if you were just fresh from Bay of Pigs and still have and the missile crisis and still have the Cold War in your head, these were alarm bells going off. So the fear was that Jamaica was becoming communist. The fear was that we had entered the Cold War, which made us very interesting to quite a few people. The year started off with Henry Kissinger visiting Jamaica. Jamaica's opinion on Angola started to matter. So we entered the Cold War, and that's why the CIA and that's why politicians and that's why the world politics started to pay attention.
You suggest in the book that the CIA had a hand in the attempt to assassinate the singer. Do you have any historical evidence that was the truth about the assassination attempt on Marley?
I don't think so. I don't think that they necessarily had a direct hand. I think that quite a few of the people, certainly indirectly in a sense that a lot of the hallmarks of the Cold War, for example, the School of the Americas, and Jamaicans, not just Jamaicans, quite a few people passed through. It's just, one of the things that was very...
Let me ask you to hold that for a minute. We'll continue talking about Bob Marley, the CIA, and Jamaica on the other side of this break. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I've been trying a long, long time, still I can't make it. Everything I try to do seems to go wrong. It seems I have done something wrong. Why they trying to keep me down? Oh, God bless, no one curse. Thank God I'm not the worst. But I must come one day. But I must come. They can't conquer me. But I must come one day. But I must come. Oh, bet I must come one day. Bet I must come.
To the town of our free rode a stranger one fine day. Hardly spoke to folks around him, didn't have too much to say.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Marlon James' new novel, which reimagines the turbulent life and times of Bob Marley in the Jamaica of the 1970s. And right now you're listening to a ballad, Big Iron, by country singer Marty Robbins, which speaks to Jamaica's culture in the 70s. You can join our conversation. Why does Bob Marley still capture our imagination all these years on? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And again, we're talking with Marlon James, author of the new book, A Brief History of Seven Killings. You can read an excerpt of the book on our website, onpointradio.org. Marlon James is with us. If you'll stand with us for a moment as we take a call from Jennifer, who's in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Hi, Jennifer. I understand you are a Bob Marley fan.
Yes, Jessica. Hello. And Mr. James, I'm looking very forward to reading your book. Bob Marley changed my entire life. His wealth of consciousness and leadership just kind of like permeated my entire being and opened the doors to the whole entire world of reggae. And, you know, when people ask me why I love reggae music, because I want to listen to music, you know, that lifts you higher and higher and that has a good message. And during times like today, there's so much strife and turmoil in the world that I think his music still is, you know, very relevant. And you know, it relates to troubles in the Middle East and problems that we hear in the USA. And I can see why it still captivates people.
Jennifer, thanks for calling. Marlon, you hear that a lot?
Yes.
He still inspires people.
Yeah, it's and it never despite hearing it quite a bit, it never stops being surprising. In the end of the book, I talk about an Afghani band, first, I think it's Afghan, I can't remember, all-girl rock band called First Rays of the New Rising Sun. The Taliban quickly got rid of them. But the few videos that still survive, I think they're on YouTube, there's Bob Marley's face in the background, and it just blew me away that he still continues to do it. A Bob Marley concert would be the only place you would find both a punk and a deadhead. 'Cause you know they despise each other. But something about that his message that just was so infinitely universal, and it just continues to renew and continue to inspire new people. The Afghani video, these girls all in hijab playing music, playing bass and guitar with him in the background was sort of both shocking and just so heartening. Mm.
It is surprising for a lot of people who don't know his history that this man who sang about peace and seemed to embody what you're talking about, bringing people together, lived in so much violence. What do we actually know about the attempted assassination against him in 1976?
We know quite a bit. We certainly know more now than we did 20, 30 years ago. Several things that just didn't add up. His security guards leaving right before the assassination attempt. Once the concert was announced, there was pretty much maximum security, as there would have been, one would expect.
But would you just pause for a minute, explain what the concert was? We haven't talked about that yet.
Well, 1976 was an election year, and tensions between political parties was exploding all over Jamaica. It was a very, very unstable and a very violent time on a local level and also on an international level with the Cold War and all of that. And Bob had the idea to have a concert, a free concert in Kingston, downtown Kingston, National Heroes Park, to sort of ease tensions between the parties. That song you began the show with was one of the song he wrote for that concert. So there was the idea was that to show that we can live peacefully, conduct peacefully, even enjoy our times without any sort of political violence involved was really important. But 2 days before the concert, several men burst into his house guns blazing, and tried to kill everybody. They shot Marley in the chest, in the arm, his wife in the head, his manager in the abdomen. Some of the band members got shot, but everybody survived miraculously. And then the peace concert went on. He at one point decided wasn't going to do it. And he was persuaded by, among other people, the R&B singer Roberta Flack, that if you don't perform, then those who tried to stop the concert would have won anyway. So he did. And the concert went off. He came on pretty late, said he was only going to play for a few minutes, and played for over an hour. His wife, Rita, was there performing in her hospital gown. And after the concert, he left Jamaica and did not come back for 2 years.
I'd love for you to read to us a little bit from the book. We've selected a passage in which one of the gang members in the book, named Bam Bam, is speaking after he has participated in the assassination attempt on Bob Marley. And this takes place as Marley is at the Smile Jamaica concert you're talking about. And he feels Marley is looking across a sea of thousands of people right at him.
Yeah. So it says, "Then you move your hand and you flash your dread and lock your stare on me. Through me, inside me, behind me, you reach straight into my heart and grab it. You say, watch the work of Rastafari. Watch him turn lion into hunter and hunter into hunted. You know I lost my gun, the gun that nearly took you. You know that even if I did have the gun, I couldn't shoot. You know that me's nothing. Me's a dead man. You know my heartbeat, the snake around my feet. You know you can will the crowd to push me down and swallow me up. You in the jungle, the bush, and you step out in the clearing for audience with His Imperial Majesty. You step forward and roll up your sleeve. Babylon tried to smite you through the hand but fail. You pull the first button on your shirt, then the second, then the third, then puff out your chest like Superman. You point to the wound on your arm and the wound in your chest. You do the war dance of victory and you relive the hunt, and everybody see but only I know. My sweat cold. You point to your wound like Jesus pointing to his side to show the work of the spear. More people on the stage now, and the pretty woman take back the mic, but not before the wind blow and the cock crow, and you pull two fists out fast like from your holster like the Cisco Kid, like Marty Robbins, like the man with no name. You throw back your head and laugh so long that the laugh don't even need a mic. You laugh at me, then stop quick and fierce, and look straight at me, your two eyes fire. I shut my eye tight until I feel you're not looking, and when I open them, you gone. And me know me dead. I can only run when I see that you leave.
It's beautiful. It's so alive. Your writing crackles. And it was a great read. I'm curious, why did you decide to do it all through the voice of people who surrounded Marley and not Marley himself?
I think because I was interested more in the periphery of this story. One reason being that there's a lot of there's a lot on Marley already, and I also didn't necessarily want to take on going into his head. I think that would be a totally different novel. And I've always been interested in the surrounding figures in the stories. Like if I see a picture of something famous happening, I want to know who's that person 100 yards back who's not looking away. This were 1963. This would have been a novel only about the grassy knoll. Yeah, I've always been interested in the people on the periphery, the people who history books will not write about, who news stories do not cover. I also think part of it is me being guided by, I never forgot Gay Talese's article, Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. And a huge part of it is, me being guided by that article where he started to interview people surrounding in the periphery of Sinatra instead of Sinatra himself. And this whole other portrait appears. I think had I not done it this way, people still, some of Bob Marley's biggest fans outside of Jamaica actually did not know he was surrounded by such violence and surrounded by such conflict. And the idea I had was to write about the conflict that was surrounding him instead of the other way around, so that people get an idea. It ultimately reinforces just how great what he achieved, because now knowing all that was set against him, you realize just how much more remarkable his achievements were.
Nikki is on the phone from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Nikki. Do you have a question for Marlon?
Hi, Jessica. How are you?
Great to hear from you. What's on your mind?
Well, I am calling because I am actually from Jamaica, and I'm now living in Atlanta. And my question to the author, great book, by the way, I can't wait to read it. But a lot of people see Bob Marley music as very romantic and free spirit, but a lot of his songs are very political against the government industrial complex. And I'd like you to really comment on that with all that we have to deal with now with the government, the Illuminati, and all of that. If you could comment more on that.
Thank you, Nikki. Marlon?
The thing about Marley that people have to remember is that Marley was a lover and a fighter. That those two weren't interchangeable for him. Those weren't contrasting things. And I think one of the disservices that we've given him, certainly in the West, is we pick one or the other. So people who love Marley as freedom fighter have very little patience for a song like Three Little Birds or One Love. And, of course, there are quite a few people who are into songs like One Love and Three Little Birds and don't realize just how furious several of his songs were. But Marley ultimately was looking at life and looking at life the way he was living life. And there was great joy and there's great sorrow and there's lots of things to be happy about. And also quite a few things to get furious about. And for him, they were never separate. They were never separate. They were never interchangeable. I think as fans and as listeners of music, I think we have the choice of cherry picking the Marley we want. Mm. He didn't have that choice. All these things are springing at the same time. An album like Exodus probably catches it best. You know, the first half are war songs and the second half are love songs. They're not two albums. That's him. And that was always him. And that's the life that he had to live, pretty much every day. So they're not interchangeable. And, I think it's the audience that probably needs to do more work and realize that these two sides are important. Not just judging Marley, but pretty much any art. You have to do it if you're going to judge Bob Dylan, too.
Would you talk a little bit about the Rastafarian ethos? What did there are a lot of misconceptions. What do the Rasta stand for?
Well, the first misconception I think people have about Rastafarianism is that it's a race movement, and it's not. So while, say, Americans may chuckle at a white Rastafarian, Jamaicans don't, because it's not a racial movement. It is a belief in Haile Selassie, you know, in the divinity of Haile Selassie and so on. But there are as many divisions to it as there are to Christianity, that, it came about again as, a displaced people trying to self-determine and self-determination and finding themselves. And Ethiopia, of course, because its historical ties to Christianity, Ethiopian Christianity is older than Western Christianity. The clear link between the Old and New Testament, the presence of an emperor and a country that was never dominated, all of this becomes hugely inspirational to a Jamaican, and not just Jamaicans. Henry Louis Gates talks about it in his book, how he and his friends would scour the Bible for references to Ethiopia, because that was the only empire we had. That was the only link to divinity, the only unconquerable black nation that we had. So it was in some ways that makes Rastafarianism almost inevitable.
So may I ask, what does Rastafarianism, I'm revealing my own ignorance here, but is it more religious than political?
It is religious. It is not political. It is religious. It's a religion. And it has its belief in the divinity of some of God and it has a belief in a Trinity just like Christianity. But it's a religion, and it's an open religion. I'm not a Rastafarian. I have many friends who are, but it is an open religion. It is all inclusive.
So it's not. It's open to any culture and any nation.
It's open to any culture. I think one of the turning points, or one of the points of conflict, I think Rastafarians had with, say, the Black Arts Movement and so on, was the fact that it wasn't necessarily pro-black, even though that was a huge part of it. But it's ultimately not a racial movement.
And would you talk about the role of drugs in both Marley's world and in informing the political environment?
I don't know in Marley's world, drugs would have just been pot, would have just been ganja, and even the status of calling it drugs is kind of anti-Rastafarian. I think what they think to them is it's not drugs. Drugs is OxyContin.
Weed is just weed.
Yeah, weed is just weed, and it's a part of religion. It's a part of the culture, and not to get into an argument about legalizing it, but it was never looked upon the way we look at cocaine. It was just never looked upon in that way, not by anybody. So it becomes a important part of the religion. But there are lots of Rastafarians who actually do not smoke weed at all.
Marlon James is joining us. He's talking about his new book on the 1976 assassination attempt on Bob Marley. And you can join the conversation. How do you imagine Bob Marley's Jamaica? Jamaicans, Jamaican Americans, how do you remember these times? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll go out now with Bob Marley's 1973 song, Midnight Ravers. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Her mind is confused with confusion. See, my problem seems there's never, never no solution. I become a nightlife rapist. And I'm begging you, please, please, for still love my poor, please don't you let me down. Nightlife rapist. Oh, nightlife rapist. Oh, please, 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 please don't let me down. Don't let me
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with novelist Marlon James about his epic new book about Jamaica's turbulent history of drugs, violence, and Bob Marley. The Velvet Underground's 1970s song, I Found Reason, is playing right now, and it includes the lyrics, "I do believe if you don't like things, you leave." One of Marlon James' characters uses those words as her mantra. You can join the conversation. How do you see Jamaica now? What is the legacy of Bob Marley? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Again, we're talking with Marlon James, author of the new book, A Brief History of Seven Killings. We'll go to the phones now. Valentine is calling from Miami Beach, Florida. Hi, Valentine.
Hi, Jessica. I wanted to ask your guest if in his research he came across anything about a gift of tennis shoes that contained a virus or a bacteria that caused Bob Marley's illness that eventually killed him. And the CIA director, I think, named Colby, who wanted to come clean about all this a few years later and was mysteriously died while rowing his boat on a lake. Did he know did any come across anything about either of those two things?
Valentine, thanks for the question. Marlon, a lot of conspiracy theories around Marley's death.
There, I've heard nearly all of them. Deal would actually answer the question. It wasn't tennis shoes, it was cowboy boots. And it wasn't a virus. It was just this needle that was in it, in the boot that went straight through his toe. Of course, conspiracy theories, there are as many theories as there is about Kennedy. So he did get a pair of boots, and there was a copper wire needle in, and it did pierce his toe. He grabbed the boot, threw it off, and they discovered it. As to what that means, nobody really knows. I think in the world of conspiracy theories, you can still be infected with cancer, but cancer is not infectious. So one can only go so far with that theory. The Colby one went into overdrive because one of the cameramen that was in the country was Carl Colby, whose father was the head of the CIA. All of that is true. And both, I think Carl Colby addressed it himself at some point because it just seemed really, really fishy. But one of the things people should bear in mind is that William Colby was not in the CIA by the time his son was in Jamaica. And also, Colby was kind of one of the problematic CIA directors. He kind of had a conscience, and he didn't last very long. So the theories, one of the things that I certainly did in the book is throw a lot of the theories in. I wasn't going to answer any of them because I don't think that's my job as a novelist anyway. But I certainly wanted to let it be aware that they were all there, and sometimes they contradict each other. But the conspiracy theories run rampant.
Let's listen to hear from Bob Marley himself. This is from a 1979 interview on 60 Minutes.
Do you think any of the Rastas have been involved in the killings in Jamaica over the years, or that's somebody else?
Rasta is involved in progress, in making understanding, like preaching traditional culture to people. Rasta no killers. You have to do good before you can be a Rasta.
You have to do good.
If he's baddie, then you're bad. If he's goodie, then you're good.
If he's baddie, then you bad. If you're goodie, then you good. So was he cleverly playing naive in some ways?
I think he was just annoyed. But I think interviewers sometimes would head into an interview and immediately underestimate him. And he was profoundly smart. Rastas were not involved in violence. That was one of the most dangerous things about them. It's the thing that makes Martin Luther King dangerous. That people who are pushing peace actually are the ones who become dangerous. And they weren't. This is one the at one point, even without people knowing, and certainly without giving them credit, Rastas were the peacemakers in Jamaica. Rasta territory was neutral ground. A Rasta vegetarian restaurant you could go and not worry about things, which is not to say everybody was a saint. But one of the things that drew people to it, and certainly drew people from all over the world to it, was the peace that it preached. And for a lot of kids, coming from those same areas, it was either Rastafarianism or gangs, or music, which is also done by a lot of Rastafari. But it was, again, it's not a violent movement. It was never a violent movement. It was always in preaching peace and love and a very healthy vegetarian lifestyle. When Marley went to the last cancer treatment clinic, they realized the one thing they didn't have to advise him on was diet, because I'm Rastafarian, I already got that covered.
Marlon, let's listen to hear from some of the folks who are Marley fans. Donston is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. I'm calling to say how Bob Marley had such an effect on little children as well. From Uganda, while I was in Uganda, one day driving in the car, my daughter says, "Who's that singing?" And I said, "That's Bob Marley." And it's the voice. She said, "That voice," and then this is when she's 2 years old. When she gets to three, she becomes obsessed with Bob Marley. Mm-hmm. Trying to listen to all different songs of Bob Marley. So I got reintroduced to songs that I not listened to because they were the popular ones. And she went to school, started telling people about Bob Marley. And most importantly, she said, "Did you go to watch any concert of Bob Marley?" I said, "No, I didn't." She said, "Why?" "Well, he's died." And she said, "Did he have any children?" And I said, "Yeah." So she started listening. She wanted me to play music by his children. So she got introduced to Ziggy Marley, Stephen Marley, and all the rest. But she keeps saying, they don't sing as well as Bob Marley. and that's, they keep, so they have a big poster of Bob Marley. People give them books. I think Bob Marley's daughter has written a book with three little birds and so on and so forth. So they know that they're big fans of that. They're now six years old. I have a son who's also three.
Thank you, Donston.
But that's a big impact that he's had. And, songs like Redemption Song is actually their most popular song, which is very touching for them that he sings with this voice and feeling.
That's Donston, and he had an influence all the way in Uganda. Thank you for the call. Mm-hmm. Jeff calling from Madison, Wisconsin. You also have a story.
Hi, Jess, Mr. James. Yeah, a quick anecdote about Bob Marley's really unique ability to unite people and stir their souls. I was a Peace Corps teacher in West Africa in the 70s trying to teach 10th graders in a lycée to francophone Malians, teaching them English, and who understandably saw very little point in my existence there. But I had a job to do, and so I tried everything to reach them. Then one day I brought in my cassette player. I chalked the lyrics to "No Woman, No Cry" on the blackboard, hit the play button, and literally within the first couple of organ strains, four of my male students jumped up to play along on air guitar. About half a dozen female students jumped up to do some background vocals. Students in the other one-story school buildings in the compound jumped out of their classroom windows, ran across the schoolyard to lean in at our windows and sing along. And afterwards, the proviseur, or the headmaster, came up to me and said, "Monsieur Klink, that was not part of the curriculum. You'll not be doing that again." And I said, "Certainly not," but presumed he meant this semester, and repeated it once a semester with each class to the same result, with air guitar, background vocals, kids jumping out of windows, and my students actually learning English. And from that day, thanks to Bob Marley, I had their attention. So I owe him a debt.
Thank you, Jeff from Madison, Wisconsin. Marley teaching folks English in Mali. And we also have Naya calling from Santa Barbara. Hi, Naya.
Hello. My name is Naya. So my family actually came from Jamaica. My dad was born there. So I'm like a first generation. So I recently, for the first time, got to go to Jamaica. And so, like he was talking about earlier, how Rastafarianism isn't a political movement. It's really a cultural movement. And so even like my dad and his brother, they got kicked out of their house, because a lot of Jamaican households are really conservative, like my goofy, you know. You can't, you know, church every Sunday, you know. So even going there, Jamaica, we went to his Bob Marley's house just to see the impact that he had. Like, he completely changed almost the world, and especially of pride, because if you go to Trenchtown, it's even right now, it's really, really rough. But just the positive message, it was such needed. And I think it did much. And also musically, you know, people don't know, like a lot of people don't know, reggae music influenced a lot of electric music, you know, with reggae dub and even a lot of hip hop.
Thank you, Naya. We appreciate the call. Marlon, would you talk a little bit? I mean, obviously he's touched people through the generations and around the world.
Yes.
How about at home in Jamaica? What's happening in Jamaica right now politically?
The thing about Jamaica is that in a lot of ways, no matter how much it changes, it stays the same. On big levels and on a small level. I think on a local level, things are changing. It's changing in business. It's changing in the way people see themselves. Even a simple thing like what your last caller mentioned, we no longer talk about is just how much persecution Rastafarians went through. They were absolutely brutalized for much of their history. So the idea that somebody, a kid, could wear dreadlocks now and nobody even bats an eyelid is a sign that the country has come a really far away. And I think there's a huge middle class, a huge, very self-determined middle class that has been pretty stable for the past 60 or so years. I mean, I'm a product of that middle class. So the narrative that usually we get about Jamaica, where it's either ghetto or plantation, hasn't been the case for decades. So I think sometimes, for example, it's assumed that I did all my education abroad, which I didn't. Yeah, I got all my books from abroad. No. So that type of world-class sophistication is there. It's always been there. That said, the politics is pretty much always the same. It's one step forward, two steps back. It's bad economic policies. It's draconian austerity measures that go nowhere. It's selling off Jamaican resources. It's selling off environment sanctuaries to really, really bad interests. It's depending on tourism to the point where we become sort of this tourist cliche. So I have to tell people, no, I do not have a no problem on T-shirt. there is progress, but for every forward movement, there's a backward one, and you get the sense that I get the sense sometimes. It's not totally true, but I do get the sense sometimes when every time I return, Jamaica is exactly where I left it.
Well, let me ask you about that. You grew up in a middle class environment. You said your parents are police officers. I understand.
Right.
How you describe in such vivid language the world of gangs and violence and the ghetto in Jamaica. Is that your imagination? How did you learn that world?
Well, it's not hard to learn it. Some of it I knew. Jamaica is still a small island. Yes, there are 100 different Jamaicas, but it's still a small island. So I was aware, you know, watch the news like everybody else. A lot of it is research. Some of it is imagination. I mean, just being a writer, I think. I think sometimes, especially when it comes to stories like these, there's this idea that every writer should be CNN or so on, or reporting live from the ghetto, which sometimes is not necessarily a challenge issued to American writers or British writers. I think that hopefully you have some talent, and with imagination and some research, you can paint a pretty accurate accurate scene. The thing is, Jamaica is a small country, so even if you're not directly affected by what's going on, you are affected. You are still within that loop, even if it's in a very small area. But ultimately, I hope that part of doing it is just the job of being a good writer, I'd think.
And you do that beautifully. You live in Minnesota, which seems
yes.
about as far from Jamaica as a person could get. Do you ever have plans to move back?
To Jamaica? Not right now. I'm pretty happy with the life I have here right now and the job I have and just doing work. I think everybody eventually wants to move back, but I think you move back when you feel that the Jamaica you want to move back to is there. And certainly when, you know, a lot of my uncles and aunts have moved back, and I think they moved back because they just wanted to retire in Jamaica. So there is always, you know, there's always that. In some ways, thanks to social media, I haven't actually left.
Yeah, that's nice. Marlon James, the book is beautiful. It was such an undertaking, far-reaching, and beautifully constructed. And I recommend it to everyone listening. Thanks for being with us. He's the author
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Of the new book, A Brief History of Seven Killings. And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going out now with Bob Marley's live performance of Jammin' from his 1978 One Love Peace concert, when the singer returned to Jamaica and famously joined the hands of the two biggest Jamaican political rivals on stage. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I wanna jive with you.